Well, good morning, Severn. Thank you for peeling yourself away from Disney Plus and making it out this morning. It means a lot to me. Joke killed at the 8:32, exactly as much as it did just now. My name is Ryan. I want to welcome you to week 12 now out of our series out of the book of 1 Thessalonians called Unfinished. We are rapidly approaching the end of this series. It's going to be over and behind us next week, but today we're going to be in chapter 5, verses 12 through 15, where I get to teach on something that I've never taught before in my time as a pastor. So let me just read it. Now we ask you, brothers, to give recognition to those who labor among you and lead you in the Lord and admonish you, and to regard them very highly in love because of their work. I did not write this either. It says, be at peace among yourselves, and we exhort you, brothers, warn those who are irresponsible, comfort the discouraged, help the weak, be patient with everyone, see to it that no one repays evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good for one another and for all. This is God's word. Before we get into this, I thought it'd be helpful to just kind of zoom out and remind ourselves of the passage, or rather the section that this passage falls in the book of 1 Thessalonians. So all the way back in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, Paul kind of pivots, and he starts a new section, and he says that for all of us who claim to be followers of Jesus, our marching orders basically just boils down to this: live a life that pleases God. That's it. And in every passage that we've looked at since those two verses, Paul has really just been elaborating on that idea and explaining what it looks like to live a life that pleases God and all these different kind of hot-button areas of life. And in doing so, what we've really seen is what makes Christianity so different from the world around it, at least what should make it so different. And so over the last several weeks, we've talked about how God expects his people to treat and view sex, about 5 weeks ago, how God expects us to treat and view our work, specifically as it relates to loving the people around us, how he expects us to treat and view death. We actually talked about that for 2 weeks, and today's passage is a lot like the ones that came before it, because again, we're looking at what makes Christianity so different from the rest of the world, but what we're looking at in these verses is really what God expects when it comes to how his people should treat and view the people that he places in our lives, specifically people that fall into three distinct categories. So, in the vein of kind of clarifying expectations and just being as straightforward as I can on the front end, if you're listening to me right now and you do claim to be a Christian, then today's talk, I just want to put this out there, has at least the potential to be one of the most practical, applicable, and challenging messages that you're going to hear me give. I got three kind of big ideas. Paul breaks it down into three different categories here, and I'm willing to bet that because of your temperament or because of the unique experiences that God's allowed you to have, one of these three ideas is going to really hit you the hardest and cause you to really rethink some things, maybe introspect, and just wrestle. But this is, my promise is, if you're a Christian, this is a passage that you can apply literally as you walk out the door today. But if you're here today and you wouldn't necessarily call yourself a Christian, but you're trying to figure this thing out, trying to figure out what you believe, you might be inclined to think, well, I guess this doesn't have a lot for me. I actually think this is a great week for you to be here, because passages like the one that we're looking at this morning really serve to give you a clear picture, not of what Christianity has become in so many different places, but what Christianity was always supposed to be as designed by God. And my conviction, and I've seen this over and over and over again as God has brought people here that had an idea of what Christianity was or what the gospel is or what church is, what I've seen over and over again is that when you just go back to the source material, what people most of the time find is that Christianity and this thing that God was designing through his son Jesus and the power of his spirit is a whole lot more reasonable, a whole lot more palatable, a whole lot more attractive than maybe what you've seen or what you've heard. So this morning we're going to talk about what God expects when it comes to how his people should view and treat other people. And Paul breaks this down into three specific categories. He talks about how we should treat people in leadership above us, how we should treat people in the family of God next to us, and finally, how we should treat people in the world around us. So let's just get started We'll camp out in verses 12 and 13. It says this: "Now we ask you, brothers, to give recognition to those who labor among you and lead you in the Lord and admonish you, and to regard them very highly in love because of their work. Be at peace among yourselves." This brings us to our first idea this morning. Favorite idea I've ever elaborated on in a teaching: God's people should treat authority differently. Let me just let you in the scenes, behind the scenes of my life. What Paul is explaining here — I'm not checking my phone, by the way, I'm going to read you something. That'd be pretty rude. What Paul is elaborating on here is not how God's people should treat authority generally, but how they should treat people who occupy positions of leadership within the church. This is hands down the most awkward thing that I've ever had to teach on a Sunday morning. And I've taught some pretty awkward topics. I'd choose all of them over this. So, approaching the pulpit this Sunday, I reached out to a friend of mine, a brother of mine, a brother in Christ, that I thought, surely, you know, this is an opportunity for iron to sharpen iron. So I reached out to him, and here's what I said. I said, "Want to know what's awkward? Being a pastor, having to teach a passage about how my church should treat me. I would gladly choose the topic of sex or death any day, LOL." That's what I said. And I expected that he was going to preach to me, you know, something like inspiring, motivating, because preachers need to be preached to too sometimes. So here's what he said back: "Ha ha, I pity you, man, I really do." So let's just get into it, all right? First thing Paul says here when it comes to, you know, how God's people, how God expects his people to treat their leaders, is to show them recognition, to give them recognition, which of course begs the question, what should they be recognized for? And in the next words that Paul says, he answers that question, and in doing so, he really gives us a behind-the-scenes look of what leadership in God's family entails, and it boils down to three words: laboring, leading, and admonishing. So I just want to walk through that real quickly. The first thing that Paul talks about is giving recognition to people who, he says, they labor among you. Now, that word labor is a Greek word that literally means to be exhausted, to grow exhausted with toil or burdens or grief. This is not a rosy picture of what it looks like to lead inside the church. What his basic first point here is, that he's trying to let the Thessalonians in on, is that sitting in a seat of leadership in God's family is really hard work. It's not as easy as it often looks from the outside looking in. And I was asking myself, why is it that Paul — if you can't tell, this is turning into a group therapy session for me, by the way, all right? Let's just do it. I was asking myself, why would Paul, under inspiration of God, of course, why would he begin by painting that picture of ministry? And to me, this is just what my experience shows, is that one of the things that makes leading in God's family unique is that everybody has a different expectation of what their church leaders should be doing and focusing on. That one of the things that just kind of sets this job apart from everybody else. And so everybody comes in with unspoken and unwritten expectations, which means that as a person in a position of leadership in the church, you're always disappointing at least half of the — it's like a referee. Every call you make, 50% of the fans don't see it that way. So I actually found an article by a guy named Tom Rainer that kind of elaborates on this idea. He pastored churches for most of his life, and I wanted to read this to you. Here's what he said. He said, "When I was a pastor in St. Petersburg, Florida, I gave a survey to the 12 deacons in the church." Nothing good has ever begun with a survey, by the way. Just put that in your pocket. "I listed several congregational responsibilities and asked them to share," and I can't emphasize this enough, "the minimum amount of time that I should average in each area each week. I listed about 20 areas, but they were free to add other responsibilities to the blank lines." And then he said, "I'm not sure exactly what I was anticipating. I just know that I was shocked when I tallied the results." So he sent out this survey to his deacons to find out what their expectations were of him regarding, you know, how much time he should be investing in these different areas. And when he added it up, he found that they expected him to work 114 hours a week. Now, for those of us that are not walking calculators like myself, that is the equivalent of working 16 hours a day, actually just over 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I emphasize this on the front end. That's the minimum expectations that they had for him, right? So that's not playing for a gift on Pastor's Appreciation Month. That's just the bare minimum. And what that article that Tom Rainer wrote really highlighted is one of the unique things about leading in God's family, that everybody has a different idea, a different expectation of what that job should really look like. And so the first thing that Paul is saying here when he talks about recognizing church leaders is recognizing that the job itself is not easy. It's labor. And in the two terms that he uses right after that, basically he gives a pretty basically a job description of what it takes to lead in God's family. He says to recognize not just those who labor, but specifically to labor to recognize those who lead you in the Lord and admonish you. That's what the labor of leadership really looks like. So when Paul talks about those who lead you in the Lord, that's a Greek word that basically has two meanings. On the one hand, it has the connotation of possessing authority and being at the head of a group of people in order to provide direction and lead them. That's what God's expectation is for people that sit in leadership positions. They actually have to lead. But the other thing, the other meaning that that word can have is to provide care for the people that are under your leadership. And really, Paul has both things in mind here. When he says leading in the Lord or leading in a way that honors God, that's what that means. It means providing direction, but also providing care. And Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17 sort of highlights this idea in a way that has always been one of the most sobering verses in the Bible to me. Hebrews 13, 17 says to obey and submit to your church leaders, but then it says why? It says because church leaders are tasked with keeping watch over the souls of God's people, and they will stand and give an account before God for the job that they do at the end of their life. So in my 7 years, I've talked to a number of guys in high school or whatever it was that had this idea that they were going to go into full-time ministry. And whenever I see somebody that's really giddy about that idea, that always just causes a little bit of pause in me, because when I read in this book about what God expects of church leaders, it's not the kind of thing that should make you giddy. Charles Spurgeon actually had a school where he would train men who wanted to go into ministry, and he's very famously quoted at cautioning every single one of them, if you can avoid going into full-time ministry, you should. Meaning, if God breaks your legs and drags you back to it and says, this is the only thing you're allowed to do, okay, then proceed with caution. But if you can do anything else, go ahead and do something else. Because if the weight of that responsibility doesn't cause you to lose a little bit of sleep, I'll just be honest with you, I can't relate to you, because that's what it does for me. The next thing that Paul talks about here, it's not just about leading, it's about admonishing. And that word just basically means to instruct and to teach God's people. And so that's what that really is about. It's about, first off, knowing what God has to say about how he expects his people to live. But then it's also about communicating that to God's people in a way that's helpful, in a way that's relevant, in a way that actually empowers them to become the people that God desires them to be. But another huge part of admonishing people means having the courage to say things that are not popular when God says it in his word. So that's really what this thing entails. It's about laboring, it's about leading, it's about admonishing. And the first thing that we read in this passage is that God's expectation is that his people would recognize those who are doing that. Now, let me just pause here. If that's all that this passage said, then you might be inclined to think, well, you know, what's so different about that? Because everybody does that, right? Like at Microsoft, they recognize Bill Gates. At Apple, they recognized Steve Jobs. That's not a uniquely Christian idea. But in what Paul chases this command with, he explains what is so unique about this in God's family. Because he says not just to recognize them, but in verse 13, he says to regard them very highly in love because of their work. Now, what that means, essentially, is that in God's family, the attitude toward those in leadership by those being led should be characterized by love. And I don't think I have to tell you, that's not something that you're going to find outside of God's family. So for instance, let me just walk you through this. As I mentioned often, I was a firefighter before I came and did this. And so I heard a lot of conversations in my 4 years as a firefighter about the fire chief, right? We talked a lot around the kitchen table over coffee about what we thought about the job he was doing. I never heard anybody say, you know what? I have this, I just have an agape kind of phileo love for our chief. My heart just goes with him. I'm in his corner 1,000%. And unless you work at a family-owned business where the founder and CEO is your mom, you're probably not going to hear a whole lot of employees talking about their leadership that way. But that's what this passage is saying God expects of his church. The picture being painted here is that leaders would devote themselves to the work of leading and teaching God's people for their good, and the people under that leadership would return by recognizing the sacrifice that they're making and regard them very highly in love because of the work that God has called them to. So before I move on from this, I just, as I was putting this together and looking at the picture that's being painted here, I couldn't help but think that if any church ever got just this one dynamic right, it would be one of the most magnetic groups of people to the rest of the world because it would be so incredibly different from the rest of the world. And the reason I say that is because when you look at culture today, or when you survey, you know, history of every civilization, the same dynamic is always presenting itself again and again and again. Here's what always happens. You don't have to teach people to do this. They just do it. People will ascend to a position of leadership, and without fail, that influence, that power, that position will change them. And they'll begin to lead in a self-serving way, and they'll begin to make decisions that benefit only them and those with them at the top, and that disadvantages those at the bottom. And so those at the bottom grow in this bitterness and this resentfulness toward those at the top, and this chasm is formed. And when you look across history, what always happens is that gets worse and worse and worse, and then the people revolt, overthrow the government, set up a new one in its place, and the same thing happens a couple of generations later. That's just what people do. What the Bible is prescribing for God's people here is radically different from that. And according to Paul's words here, what an unbelieving world should say when it looks inside the family of God is, I have never seen anywhere, I have never seen those in leadership and those under leadership interact the way that they do in God's church. And, you know, I might not agree with everything that they say or everything that they teach or everything that they do, but I would give anything. I would give anything if things were more like that in my family or my city or my country. That's the picture that's being painted here in just these first two verses. It's that God's people should treat authority differently. So here's where we go next in verse 14. It says, "And we exhort you, brothers, warn those who are irresponsible, comfort the discouraged, help the weak, and be patient with everyone." This is going to bring us to our next idea this morning, is that God's people should treat each other differently. What you're seeing in just verse 14 is really what God expects for how individual followers of Jesus should interact with each other inside the church. And to kind of give you an idea of how radical a teaching this is, let me just tell a story that you can probably sympathize with. You can probably relate to. So earlier this year, I got a call from somebody that I hadn't heard from in about 10 years. And 10 years ago, I would have considered us very close friends. Went to the gym together. You know, we went to parties together. We hung out all the time. Saw each other a number of times a week. And so I hadn't heard from him in about a decade. I was excited. So I swiped right. Wanted to see what's going on with him. Maybe, you know, what's going on? Maybe he needs to get, you know, somebody to do his wedding or something like that. I was looking forward to connecting. So anyway, we're talking on the phone and we were catching up. And then all of a sudden in the conversation, I could, and if this has ever happened to you, you know what I'm saying, but it's difficult to describe. I could sense there was like a transition in the tone of his voice that almost signified now we had arrived at the time in the conversation where he was going to say what he really wanted to say the whole time. Like, I don't know if you ever had a conversation with somebody where you're sitting and you can just tell there's like this weird fluff between you. There's something that they really need to say. You know that they need to say it, but you just got to bide some time. And then they finally get there. So we arrived at that point. And he explained to me once we arrived at this point in the conversation that he had just gotten into real estate and he had an exciting opportunity for me. And he was wanting to know how he could help me, and I just said, no thanks, dude. No thanks, buddy. Great to hear from you, though. And just like that, the conversation was over, and stunningly, I haven't heard from him since. Now, when I got off the phone with him, I just had this bad taste in my mouth because it was very clear to me, as this illustration demonstrates, that he didn't call me because, you know, he valued me as a person, or he valued what we once had together, or, you know, however you want to phrase that. He was just networking me, right? He was scrolling through his phone book, and he saw my name, and he thought, well, maybe I could put some money in my pockets, you know, through this guy. Little he know, I don't have any money in my own pockets. And once he figured out that that wasn't, that I couldn't be a means to his end, well, that was that. That was the end of the conversation. And if you've ever been treated that way, you know how off-putting that is, right? Nobody needs to teach us that it's not a fun thing to know that you're being used as a means to somebody else's end. But when I look across just culture, not just in our country, but across the world, what's clear is that that is on autopilot the way that the vast majority of people are treating each other. Like, very rarely do people naturally treat each other with the respect and the honor and the dignity and the love that they are owed as people created in the image of God. What's far more common is that people just network each other and they form these partnerships and these relationships and these connections, not because they're genuinely interested in the person on the other side of the table, but because in the back of their mind, they know I can benefit from this partnership in some way, shape, or form. Now, the reason that I use this as an example is because by antithesis, it shows that God is calling his people to a radically different relational ethic inside his family. And to explain what I mean, let me just walk through these three commands. The first command here is to warn those who are irresponsible. All right, now, this word irresponsible, that's a Greek word that literally means disorderly or out of ranks. And it was commonly used to refer to soldiers in the Roman Empire. So you could think of, when Paul talks about the irresponsible, you could think about them as people that just, for whatever reason, can't seem to get their life together. They're problem children. They're always out of line. They're always falling apart. There's something that's just busted up and broken in some area of their lives all the time, no matter what. Paul is saying, warn them. All right, the next thing that he talks about here is comforting the discouraged. And what he's talking about when he's talking about the discouraged is people that are just completely burdened and really broken because of a kind of grief that they're going through. Grief from some tragedy in life, like the unexpected loss of a loved one, which we know from this letter, a lot of people in the Thessalonian church were dealing with that. That's why Paul, under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, spent so much time talking about the hope that we have in the face of death because of what Jesus has done for us. So Paul is saying, comfort those people that are grieving, that are mourning, that are just, you know, a puddle of sadness. Be there for them and comfort them. And then the last thing that he says here is to help the weak. Now, the weak, that could be physically weak people that just can't care for themselves in a physical sense. It could be socioeconomically weak people that just can't provide for themselves. You know, they're going to get put out. They can't put food on the table, whatever it is. Or it could be spiritually weak people that are new to the faith but are still figuring this thing out, and they're just riddled with insecurities about, you know, does God really love me? And they're just people that can't seem to stand on their own two feet. And when this verse says to help them, that doesn't mean just, you know, fire them a text every once in a while and see how they're doing. It means to devote yourself. That's what that Greek word help literally means, devote yourself to them. Be a person that a weak person can actually lean on when they don't have the strength to stand themselves. Now, the reason I walk through that is to highlight something. What these three groups of people have in common, they really have one thing in common. Irresponsible people who just can't seem to get their own life together. Discouraged people who can't seem to get over whatever kind of emotional pain they're dealing with. And weak people who just can't even stand on their own two feet. What they all have in common is this. They have nothing to offer you. Those groups of people are the kinds of people that the rest of the world looks at, assesses, and dismisses, writes them off, because there's no return on your investment when you invest in people like that. And yet what Paul is writing here, he's writing to let us know that what God is saying is that he expects his people to care for, invest in, and look out for the kinds of people that the rest of the world forgets about, that in his family, they're not going to fall through the cracks. That's his expectation for how we get down in the church. And this idea of investing in people that cannot benefit you in any way, shape, or form, this is exactly what Jesus taught personally during his time here. In Luke chapter 14, verse 12, Jesus said, when you give a lunch or a dinner, Don't invite your friends, your brothers, your relatives, or your rich neighbors, because they might invite you back and you would be repaid. On the contrary, when you host a banquet, invite those who are poor, maimed, lame, or blind, and you will be blessed. And then Jesus says why you'll be blessed, because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. What Jesus was prescribing there could not have been more radical for the culture that he was born into, because Jesus was born into what's called a shame and honor culture, right? And in a shame and honor culture, your most precious possession was your reputation. So when Jesus is talking about here, when you throw a banquet, this is not something that you do on a weekly basis. This could be something that you might only really have the opportunity because of limited financial resources or whatever it is. This might be something that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you. So everybody in Jesus' day knew that you're a fool if you don't take advantage of that. So what everybody in Jesus' day just knew this. You didn't question this. It's just how you do things. If you're going to throw a banquet, you invite the most prominent people from your own family and the most prominent people from your own community in the hope that by inviting them and rubbing shoulders with them, maybe impressing them, making some kind of impression with them, that you're going to benefit yourself in some way, shape, or form. And Jesus is speaking directly into that mindset with these verses. And he is explaining that following him, Jesus is saying, following me means making relational decisions that will not make sense to the rest of the world. They will cut against the grain of the way that everybody else says you should be doing things. And what Jesus is saying here is not only should you not invest in people so to be repaid by them? Jesus is saying intentionally invest in people who do not have the ability to offer you anything and so therefore will actually only cost you. And that is exactly what Paul is saying in these verses in 1 Thessalonians. This is exactly what we're seeing is God's expectation for every one of his followers. Now, before I move on from this point, I want to highlight something that I think it's actually the most important thing for our church to see specifically at this point in our history. So I'd ask you to lean in here. And I hope that none of this sounds, you know, offensive or anything like that, because it's certainly not my intention. But I think the most important thing to see in just 1 Thessalonians 5:14 is who these commands are aimed at. Because when you talk about on a Sunday morning, when you talk about warning the irresponsible, comforting the discouraged, and helping the weak, most people in a church setting are going to hear that and think that's a great idea for pastors and elders and, you know, full-time staff and all that kind of stuff. But that's not who these commands are aimed at here. These commands are aimed at every single follower of Jesus that made up the church in the ancient city of Thessalonica. And so here's what that means for us today. The responsibility, the command to care for people that are easy to write off and to make sure that nobody falls through the cracks in God's family is not a command that God just gives to pastors or elders or small group leaders or professional Christians, whatever that even means. This is an expectation that God has for every single man and woman who gives their life to his son, Jesus. Now, the reason I think this is so important to just camp out on rather than mouse over is because, let me just say something that most of us already knew. In the last 5 years, this place has changed a whole lot. For those of you that have been here for the last 5 years and beyond, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think you could make a reasonable case that the only constant in the last 5 years has been change. And one of the most dramatic changes is that 5 years ago, we were a one-service church. And here we are today, a three-service church. This service right now is bigger than the church was 5 years ago. We have about 300 more people averaging on a weekend attendance than we did 5 years ago, which is great. But here's one thing that I've heard, and this is a valid concern. I appreciate that I've heard this. One thing that I've heard from people that have, you know, that are a part of Classic Severn, as I refer to it, is this concern that we're going to lose the personal touch. That we're going to lose this tight-knit sense of community that you know, we were once known for and that is, frankly, a lot easier to maintain in smaller churches. That's a valid concern. If God has put that on your heart, I just want you to know, God put that on your heart, right? We don't naturally care about that. That's the evidence of God in your life. But I want you to see something here. If that if what I'm saying right now describes you and that's ever been a concern of yours, I just want you to see that according to the Bible, it's up to you to make sure we don't lose that. That according to this passage of Scripture, it is every single member's responsibility to make sure that we are a community of people that cares for each other. God's desire was never that groups of Christians would pop up and then, you know, a handful of people would try to care for several dozen or several hundred. His desire was that as he saved people in every tribe, nation, and tongue and filled them with the Spirit, that those believers would then exercise their God-given gifts for the mutual edification of his people so that we would be a mutually sustaining community that cares for each other so that we could then be the hands and feet of Jesus in a world that really needs Jesus. So secondly, and I think this is so important for all of us to understand, God's people should treat each other differently. Amen? Here's where Paul ends here in verse 15. It says, "See to it that no one repays evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good for one another and for all." This is going to be our third, it'll be our last idea this morning. It's that God's people should treat the world differently. The world differently. So what Paul is pointing out here at the end is how individual Christians are to interact not with other Christians inside the fold of God, but actually outside in the world around us. Because he says that we should pursue what's good for one another, not just for one another, but for all. And this really is the final thing that should really just set these communities of Jesus followers called churches apart from the rest of the world. And to illustrate what I mean, let me do something that I don't normally do and get a little bit political on a Sunday morning, all right? Take the glasses off for this one so I can't see if anybody's mad at me. It's not that bad. It's really not that bad. I'm willing to bet that everybody listening to me right now knows the four-word slogan that encapsulates Donald Trump's campaign philosophy. It's summarized with the acronym MAGA, and it stands for Make America Great Again. All right? Now, regardless of what you think of Donald Trump, and I cannot emphasize this enough, I don't want to know what you think about. Do not talk to me about what you think about Donald Trump. This is so not the point of this. Regardless of that, let me ask you this. How far do you think a U.S. politician would have gotten climbing the ranks, you know, to the highest office in the land if their campaign slogan was, "Make France Great Again," or "Make China Great Again," or, you know, "Make the moon great again," or whatever, right? Not very far is the answer. Because what any politician that hopes to get elected knows at the end of the day is that the average American citizen is thinking about one thing when they go to the polls. You know what it is? The average American citizen. And it in any different, in any other corporation or organization or group of people, I remember when I was in the fire department, every year we got into contract negotiations with the county. And every year we wanted the same thing. An easier schedule with more pay and better benefits, right? Every single year. Problem with that is there's a limited number of resources and every department's fighting for them. With that in mind, here's what I never heard in one of those meetings. I never heard somebody stand up and say, "You know what? I think police officers should get paid more and we should willingly let go of the raises that we would have for the sake of the police department." If somebody had said that as a firefighter, they'd have run him over with the fire truck. You never hear from him again. Because at the end of the day, ever since God made people and sin entered the world, every group of people has one thing in common. Whatever the clan, the tribe, the country, the nation, what we all do on autopilot is we look out for ourselves, right? And if there's anything left over after that, we can talk about divvying out the scraps, but our first priority is us. And with that reality in mind, what 1 Thessalonians 5:15 is it's God saying that he expects a radically different ethic in his people. God's desire is that what would set his people apart from the rest of the world is that everywhere churches popped up, they would pursue the good of the rest of the world. Now, for Christians living in the Roman Empire, that meant pursuing the good of people that disagree with you, that persecute you, that imprison you, that confiscate your property, and in just a few short years would be killing you. And God is saying, "I expect you to pursue their good." Period. Why? Because that's exactly what God has done for us in Jesus. So this is what God desires his community called the church to look like. That inside this community, there would be a dynamic between those in leadership and those under leadership, unlike anything you'll find in the rest of the world. that there would be a care and concern for those that the rest of the world would write off and say are hopeless inside his family, you're not going to find anywhere else, and that there would be this outward-facing selflessness in his people that sought the good not just for ourselves, but for those around us who might disagree with us and maybe even violently oppose us. So when I zoom out from this all the way, frankly, I think passages, I don't know, you know, where you're coming from here, but when I zoom out from passages like this, I just can't help but being inspired by the vision it paints of what a church could be. And I'll just be perfectly honest with you. I would be ecstatic about being a part of a group of people that are known for the things that this passage says we should, as God's people, be known for. The question that I have is, how do we get better at it? And the answer is very simple. It's Jesus. The guy who wrote this letter, Paul the Apostle, did not go from being Saul the murderer to Paul the missionary because he woke up one day and was sick and tired of being sick and tired. He changed because one day he met Jesus and he understood that Jesus was God and went to the cross for every one of his sins, even though he was wrong about everything he thought he was right about. And as he walked with Jesus, sure enough, Jesus radically transformed the way that he viewed and treated every single person that God brought into his life. And that formula works as well for us as it did for him 2,000 years ago. That formula doesn't ever change. So let me end the way that I started. I don't know how this teaching hits you, but I'm willing to bet that there's one of these three points that just, it was harder for you than the other two. Now, maybe for you, it was the part of this teaching that dealt with how God expects you to treat those in leadership. Maybe that's really hard for you. Maybe that's a sore subject for you because of hurts that you've experienced, pains that you have, you know, burdens and baggage that you're still carrying around, and I validate all of that. Maybe that's the hardest thing for you. Or maybe the hardest thing for you was the second idea about how God expects you to treat the people next to you in this family. Maybe you've been down that road. And you've put yourself out there and you've opened up your life just to find out somebody's gossiping about you behind your back or they burned you or whatever it is. Or maybe it was the third idea that's hardest for you, this idea of how you should treat people out in the world around you. Maybe you've been out in that world and you don't want anything to do with that world anymore. Maybe you'd love to just kind of be this reclusive, kind of Amish-feeling community. I don't know what part of this teaching was the hardest for you to think about or apply to your life, but I know this. The only way that you and I are going to really change when it comes to the way that we treat people is when we come to a deeper understanding of how God has treated us in Jesus. Because there is nothing that will more holistically change our hearts than coming to a deeper understanding of the reality that while we were sinners, when we had nothing to offer God, when we had nothing to look forward to, when we were the reason that we were where we were, into that reality, Christ demonstrated his love for us and died for us. And it's as that reality dawns on us individually and corporately. This is the reason I preach Jesus every week. You got full permission to not honor me or respect me. You can fire me if I stop doing that. Because it's as that reality dawns on us that we become changed from the inside out and we can become this kind of community that God desires his church to be.